Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I am your host. I am very, very excited about the conversation I'm about to have with Doug Labov. But first, a couple of little sponsorship. Let's first start off with John Catt from Hachette Learning. They sponsor this podcast, and they produce great, great books around evidence-informed instruction, including my book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. I will put, you know, a link to those in the show notes. Go ahead and check out some books from John Catt. They really are great. And if you're looking to, you know, publish a book, I really recommend you talk to them, because they are very, very good at getting teachers off the ground and running with the publishing process. The other sponsor that I'd like to mention is StepLab. I'm the director of StepLab North America, and we have incredible content for instructional leaders and coaches, including video content from Teach Like a Champion. So I would go and check out StepLab. I put a link in there to get a demo and get yourself started. I think it's fantastic if you're trying to get great teaching, effective evidence-based instruction up and running in your school. So give that a gander. Doug Labov, it is so great to have you back on the podcast. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. As you know, I'm a big, big fan of the show, so it's exciting for me. And can I say, I don't know if I'm allowed to plug your book on your podcast, but if even bigger fan of the show, Just Tell Them has been so great for, so powerful for me to use with teachers to help them to really envision how direct instruction, explicit direct instruction works and can work in the classroom. So, hats off to you for that. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate that. We haven't talked about this, but I was genuinely surprised and perhaps emotional in private of seeing screenshots, people in London, people across the United States, like taking pictures in your trainings and seeing Just Tell Them there. It was surreal. So I do appreciate some of that embedding.
It's great. It's great work. It deserves to, you know, love to make it more visible, because it's just so, you know, I think we have something in common, which is we want to try and make real teaching advice, real research-driven, cognitive science-informed teaching advice, not just legible to teachers, but practical, like to understand what I should do and understand how I'm going to do it on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. in front of 30 seventh graders. Those are totally different things. So I think just like a beautiful translation is a beautiful thing. And maybe I think it's a lot of what's so powerful about Just Tell Them, and certainly what I think, you know, we try to do with our books at Teach Like a Champion. Hopefully we're as successful.
Let's talk about Teach Like a Champion, or the cool kids say TLAC, I think is what they're and so for the cognitive load of the audience, I try to, you know, if I end up sliding into the TLAC lingo, that's what I'm talking about. Teach Like a Champion was a book that came to me in 2.0 when I was surprisingly not in a high needs disadvantaged school, which I think sometimes mm-hmm. people associate it with. It was for a very brief moment, it was a school that was very well off and, you know, cost, you know, quite a bit of money in tuition. And I found it to be marvelous and eye opening. That was back in 2010. Mm-hmm. Like, tell me about like Teach Like a Champion now in 2025.
Yeah, well, there's a 3.0 version of the book, which I'm happy to say I think is a really big step forward that tie-ins to cognitive science, which I think is one of the themes in our workshops more broadly, that we've really come to believe in the importance of a mental model for teachers, that you have to have a picture of what it looks like in your mind, of what it looks like when it's done right. And if you have that, you know, I think there's a ton of research that having a really clear mental model of what learning looks like helps you to make decisions, because the tools and Teach Like a Champion, they are tools, and they help teachers to become the best version of themselves, whether they teach in a high poverty district or in a private school, you know, wherever they teach. The goal is to help you be the best version of yourself possible. And that requires tools and not a program. And that's what I just feel strongly that that's what Teach Like a Champion is or should be. I'm not telling you should throw out everything you do, but just let me help you think about the decisions that you make and how they could be more optimal. But I think for tools to be effective, you have to have a picture of what the end product looks like and how learning works, and then people make better decisions. Is it possible to use a technique like cold call and do it poorly? Of course. You know, it's a powerful tool. If you want to renovate your kitchen, you will need an angle grinder, you know, for tile and cutting pipes and like Is it a powerful tool? Is it a necessary tool? For sure it is, but could you misuse that tool? You know, should you do you need to know how to use it well and what the end product, what the end goal looks like? Absolutely. So the newest version of, I'd say, that book, and even our Science of Reading book, which is out this summer, is really like tries to do, I think, what I described in your book, which is to translate, start with the cognitive science, let us tell you what the science says, then let's talk about how to translate it. Those are very different things, like understanding the research and translating them. So that's big in the book. And I think that if you came, if folks came to one of our workshops this year, we have a foundations workshop, which I think is for K-1-2 teachers who do systematic synthetic phonics. It's such a the best thing that's happened in American education in the last 5 years is the pivot by thousands of districts to systematic synthetic phonics, thanks to Emily Hanford's podcast, Sold a Story. But just because you choose a systematic synthetic phonics curriculum, like the work is not done. They're hard to teach. They're hard to teach well. It's really important when better sound correspondence cards, for example, for them have to be looking at the card. And while they make the sound, if they're not looking at the card and associating the letter image with the sound, it's not working, right? So where they're looking is really important, and how, you know, they should get a lot, they're going to need a lot of repetition. And so, you know, whether you're cold calling and doing call and response or balancing between the two, those decisions are really important. So we have a workshop on like how to take found it's a Foundations of Literacy workshop, how to take a curriculum like that and teach it every day. We have a Science of Reading workshop and a Science of Learning workshop that I think we're just really excited about. I hope that we're at a point of inflection where the teaching profession in America becomes more research valuing, more research literate, more, you know, more cognizant of the research and its importance. So that's something we've really been trying to focus on our team. Sorry for the long-winded answer there, but.
No, absolutely. I've had a lot of guests on, and I've had a lot of private conversations with folks who are in the research realm, or maybe they're into policy advocacy. They're trying to get school boards to like just make a shift and move away from programs that are not evidence-based and try to adopt better programs. And then what I keep wanting to that people to realize is there's a missing element, which is the instruction, like the delivery. That's why I'm so excited to get my hands on the Science of Reading book, the Teach Like a Champion Guide. How did that come about? Like, what's the origin story of that?
We started out, so, you know, in maybe 5 or 6 years ago, Colleen Driggs, Erica Woolway, and I wrote a book called Reading Reconsidered. And I think it was a we love the book. And it's about what does the craft of teaching look like in a domain-specific setting in English and reading classes? You know, I was an English teacher. Everything we teach in schools is important, but reading is the most important thing. How do we make those classrooms rigorous and demanding and learning optimal? We set out to write the 2.0 version of that book, and we realized along the way that a couple of things had changed, and that really, like, this book was qualitatively different. It wasn't a sequel. And I think one, we spent the last, we have a curriculum we call Reading Reconsidered, which is a 5 to 8 middle school reading curriculum. It's now expanding into high school. So we've spent 6 years trying to write a curriculum of daily lesson plans built on great books. And we just learned so much there that it kind of, that plus everything we learned about cognitive science, and not just what we learned about cognitive science, but the what is relevant in cognitive science has changed in the last 5 to 10 years. You know, the first chapter is about attention and how profoundly important attention is to teaching reading, that reading is such an attentionally demanding task. I'm sure you feel this yourself. I feel myself, my ability to sustain my focus on challenging text is it's more fraught. It's more challenging for me even. And I'm a dedicated reader. But for students, it's 10x. You know, the social media and the cell phone are attention fracturing machines. Are we going to give up on books? Like, what are we going to do about that in the classroom? So the first chapter is about just the story of attention and how important it is to be attentive to attention and to think about attention in the classroom. And that's brand new. So, and the result is that we just realized as we were writing it, that given all we learned about curriculum and cognitive science and new challenges in reading, you know, another new challenge in reading is the death of the book. I don't think most parents realize how rarely kids read books, never mind great books, cover to cover in the classroom anymore. Does that matter? It absolutely matters. And so I think we realized that this was just this is just a this is a new book. And it needed to have Science of Reading. We wanted to call it Beyond Phonics because it's sort of the, so after we do systematic synthetic phonics and we have letter sound correspondence, you know, let's call that in third grade, second or third grade, what happens to students for the rest of their careers through college, including college? And what happens in our schools is not, it's not aligned to the science. It's not as good as it could be. Misserve students, and with the book fighting for its life, for its relevance in our society, those issues are, you know, 10x more important. And so, you know, we just realized halfway through that this is not a sequel, this is a brand new book, and that became the Teaching a Champion Guide to the Science of Reading.
I feel like there's a thread across that and a lot of the guests on this podcast where, like, do we give up like on the book? Do we give up on attention? Do we give up on math facts? Do we give up on, you know, algorithms? And it's like,
do we give up on hard? Do we give up on hard things? Right.
Yeah. I mean, I know we're mutual friends with Robert Pondicio, and like I was reading a blog he was talking about like change agents and so on. And it just made me think like the most important and almost radical thing that you can do that is within the right or within the public's sort of allowance is to teach the curriculum really, really well and systematically with a high level of rigor. And I just feel like that's just been, it's just slowly been deteriorating, or maybe it's coming back. I'm just not sure.
I hope it's coming back because I do think that we lost sight of it. And I think that that has had tragic consequences, that it will take us 10 years, you know, to address. If you want to be a radically better classroom, is like, that is what matters. Radically better at teaching reading, radically better at math, radically better at science. Can I just point out that we're increasingly becoming a society where science is critical to every endeavor. Never mind, like, I mean, included are global security as a democratic nation. You know, look at how central the role of science is to the Ukraine war. Meanwhile, 60% of the students in PhD programs in advanced sciences in the United States are foreign nationals, specifically, and bless them, it's wonderful that they want to, but like, they're foreign nationals, first of all, from countries that we have a tenuous global, you know, geopolitical relationship, from China, from, you know, from Russia, from India. And it's wonderful that those people are here in our universities, but it's also true that we cannot fill the seats in those advanced programs with the graduates of our own domestic science programs, and that should scare the daylights out of us, right? That our science is insufficiently rigorous. Also, to me, it's a national security issue. So hopefully, we are the pendulum is swinging back to the realization that the greatest thing we can do to serve our students well is to give them a radically better education every day in the classroom, focused on teaching the curriculum emphatically well. And hopefully that also includes, you know, more rigorous, better curriculum.
Absolutely. So I think of Teach Like a Champion as the guide for teachers that want to embrace that understand that, you know, time is precious. This is the one chance for every child to have, you know, to have a world-class, you know, education. And so there are some heavy hitters in here. And I actually really wanted to kind of find clusters in the book this time rather than focus on, you know, like self-interrupt or some like small micro technique. And so this actually comes out of something I saw you do in Birmingham. You actually did a whole day on what to do cycle that sort of occasioned a lot of conversation for leaders and so on. Can you, for people who are not familiar with the what to do cycle, maybe break that down for us, and then you can kind of relate, I think, all of this to attention and to cognitive load and so on, sort of in the 3.0 style of Teach Like a Champion.
Great. I'm really glad you asked about this, because I think that in some ways, the what to do cycle is about one of the most mundane things that we do. One mundane and familiar things that we do as teachers, which is to give directions and ensure follow through to those directions. We do it so frequently, so often, that it's easy for us to not pay attention to us. One of the, like, I don't know if you know this, I had a brush with, I was in a PhD program in English for a long time. I'm not anymore. I'm glad that I did not go that direction. But one of the phrases that stuck with me from one of my really good professors was threshold of narrativity, that he was talking about, I won't go into which novel, but it's the idea that, like, the narrator talks about things that traditionally would be thought about as beneath the threshold of narrativity. They're not worth talking about or valuable to talk about. That phrase stuck with me because there's so many things that are profoundly important in the classroom that somehow are beneath our perceived threshold of narrativity. We don't think they're that important, but actually they're profoundly important. And all the sublime and beautiful things that we do as teachers are built on this foundation of incredibly mundane things, and directions are one of them. So the what to do cycle starts with clear, concrete, observable directions. I have this beautiful video of a first year teacher outside Birmingham, England, by the way, and she's just like, the kids are so, they're working so hard and so positively and so productively. And so much of the reason for it is that her directions are crystal clear and consistent, and they're consistent for the routines in her classroom. And in part, it's because she practiced them. Like, who practices, who scripts their directions and practices their directions? Not many teachers. But the benefit of this is, like, there's no, students know how to be successful, right? They know exactly what she's asking them to do when she's asking them to do it. There's no ambiguity. So there's no like, oh, I thought, you know, either like, one of the worst things that can happen as a class in the classroom is you give a direction, you think it's clear, it's not clear to the kids, they don't follow the direction, and then you're mad at them. And then they're like, you know, there's a consequence for students of some sort, which is you're like, pay attention. What does it mean to pay attention? I was paying attention. You know, her directions are crystal clear, notebooks down, eyes up here, you know, and she's practiced them that she can give these directions with no load on her own working memory, right? They're almost like a habit for her. And so while she's giving her directions, she is able to look and see, are they following directions? Who looks engaged? Who does not look engaged? Who should I call on next, right? I think one of the most overlooked factors in the classroom is the influence of work of loads on teachers' working memory. And so by making these her directions almost a habit for her, she frees her working memory to be more, doing more important things. So the first step in what to do directions is just consistent, crisp, clear, concrete directions. And then the most important habit I want to build in the classroom is following through on the teacher's directions. So there are three steps that are what I would describe as like managing the after. And the first one is just looking. Like, one of the things we know about people is when they know that they are observed, their behavior changes. And so the first thing after you give directions is just to scan the classroom for yourself. So you notice whether students are following through and making a habit of like, I give a direction and I scan the classroom, right? Just, and so then I'm more likely to notice whether students are following directions. I see this all the time in classrooms. Teacher gives directions. Students are not following it. Teacher does not notice. Now students are aware that there is a great deal of like, there's a great deal of opportunity. My teacher won't notice. Maybe my teacher doesn't care if I really follow through. But if the students see me looking, then they know that I care. And they know that I will notice whether they don't follow directions. And that is a disincentive, and prevention is always better than cure. And maybe while I'm scanning, I want to do something called be seen looking, which is just to engage in a few sort of almost pantomime behaviors to make it clear to students that I'm looking. So maybe I raise my chin slightly, or I stand up on my tiptoes while I give my like pencils down and eyes on me. And, you know, maybe I crane my head to the side slightly just to make it clear that I'm to make it clear to students that I'm looking carefully to see whether they follow through. And if I do that and I show that it matters to me, right there, I'm going to cause the rate of follow through to increase dramatically. The next thing that I need to do is then I want to, what Peps McRae calls, amplify the norm, amplify the positive norm. One of the things we know about people is that the single greatest influence, this is quoting Pep's book on motivation, motivated teaching, the single greatest influence on the individual is the individual's perception of the group norm. What do I think is normal in this classroom? Does everyone follow directions in Mr. Groschel's classroom? And so if I can amplify the norm, thank you, Zach. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate you following directions like that. I make it more clear. I show my appreciation to those students, which is important, but I make it more clear to the other students that the normal thing in this classroom is lots of people following through. And then the last thing I need to do is to have a tool to very quickly, non-disruptively correct students who are slow to respond or who have not responded. One of the great things about directions is they're often asked, when they're effective, they're asking for very small things. Put your pencils down. Put your pencil down. Eyes up here. Take out your notebook. And that is an opportunity because it's such a simple task to ensure follow through with a very simple fix, right? I'm not asking you to do something complex. So if I'm going to just do something like, maybe if I'm giving directions to my class and they notice that, Zach, you're not following directions, if I can just say, pencil down, Zach, and I can whisper it instead of saying it out loud, right, then it's less invasive. It's almost like it's quieter. Or I can say, I'm waiting for one pencil to be down. And maybe there's a moment of eye contact between you and me. Thank you, Zach. Something like that. Or maybe it's even a nonverbal, which is I just make a signal to you to put your pencil down. Now I can fix small things with almost invisible fixes. And what I'm doing here is building the most foundational habit, which is when I give a direction, everyone follows the direction. And if I have that habit, the table is set for me for rigorous, rich, exciting, fascinating discussion on any topic that I need. And generally, I think, like, are these sorts of things below the threshold of narration? Yes, they are, but they're really, really important. So the what to do cycle is clear, concrete, observable directions, be seen looking, narrate the positive, least invasive intervention on one or two students who aren't following through. And if you do that consistently, you will be well on your way to a beautiful, robust culture in your classroom that students will love, and you will love teaching, and students will love being taught.
I love it. And one of the things that I got out of watching you present on this, which was really powerful, I think it's just, if you read the book, you actually read the text and you don't just like get some sort of like little infographic version of Teach Like a Champion, like, and you read the narrative, you say this over and over again. The powerful thing was you kept talking about purpose over power. You kept talking about honoring students' dignity through the least invasive intervention. I mean, what I think people do is they listen to this and they go, great, that's a cycle for ensuring compliance or whatever. Like, maybe unpack maybe unpack that, because you do it better than anyone I know. Like, there's just this view in education that compliance isn't necessary, but also that it gets in the way, I suppose, of maybe more engaged critical thinking, or you know, there's a lot of sort of power struggles that you're doing between a teacher and a student. So maybe unpack that for us.
Yeah, happy to. And you should just prompt me to like talk about some, like there's a lot here, but a couple things that I'll point out, which is students have the right to know what they should do to be successful in the classroom. They should have the right to know that like paying attention matters, that if I look at the person who's talking, I will learn more, and that will cause me to be successful. They have a right to know how to complete the tasks that will give them the opportunity to be successful. I think that there has been in the last 5 years a large-scale misunderstanding of the difference between authority and authoritarianism. And they're not just not the same thing. They're almost opposite things. There will always be authority in the classroom. You are invested as a teacher with authority for a reason, because there are things that you must teach to give people the best life opportunity they can have. And the client, who are the parents who have sent their children to you, like, they are counting on you to teach algebra or science or The Giver or history, right? That is an immense responsibility, and it comes with authority. Ensuring that people follow through, that there's a culture where follow through is normal, where students don't just have the right to learn. Where like, if I'm willing to be the student who is the only student work, you know, that the unspoken message to a lot of students in a lot of schools in this country is like, you have the right to learn. So if you want to, you know, defy the norms of all the kids who are barely paying attention, who are not working that hard, and you want to be the one kid who's the outlier, you have the right to do the things that will cause you to be a doctor someday. That is not fair to the student. Like, you should not have to be willing to be a social outlier in order to achieve academic success. The environment should make it easy for you to be attentive and positive and work hard and learn a lot and make it seem normal. And so our authority as teachers is just profoundly important. At the same time, we're asking students to do something that is hard. It's hard to sustain your attention all day. It's hard to work hard all day. It's hard to self-regulate. And so as students struggle, I should correct them and remind them of what the right thing to do is and encourage them to do the right thing, but do so in a way that assumes the best about them and preserves their dignity and reminds them. That's why I think it's so clear, so important that it's clear what the task is, give really good directions so everyone knows what they should be doing. And then just to give very non-invasive, make sure, you know, check to make sure that you're tracking the speaker. One more set of eyes tracking the teacher, right? Those are both corrections that don't name the student. Right, they just and maybe I emphasize it a little bit by looking at the student that I'm talking about there, but I'm trying to find ways to make sure that I can give lots of corrections when necessary in a way that doesn't disrupt the learning or cause the student to feel like I don't care about them, right? It's purpose, not power. My purpose is to teach you. And if I want to teach you and I really believe in your capacity to learn, I have to have high expectations for you. And my goal is to change you, to cause you to be more attentive than you would left to your own devices, to work a little harder than you would left to your own device. That's what a teacher does for students that they care about. I do feel like in some places people have lost sight of that. But I think that endures. And if you think about the teachers who have profoundly influenced you over your life, someone was asking me this the other day, the most important teacher that I ever had who taught me how to read as an English major, I almost went to a PhD in literature, was this teacher that I had in ninth grade, Mr. Simmons, who I didn't like at all at the time. He was very clear and very, he wasn't fun and he wasn't cool by any stretch of the imagination. And I thought what I wanted was cool. And 10 years later, I realized that he was the person who taught me to read and that everything I did in my, you know, like my PhD program was like, because he taught me how to close read a text. And yeah, I'll just pause there. But I think like our capacity to cause students to do a little more than they would do left to their own devices is one of the gifts that we give them.
Absolutely. I kind of want to go back to this. You use the word mundane when it comes to this, right? Mm-hmm. It's like on the one hand, it's somehow controversial to get kids to do stuff better. On the other hand, the system of what to do when you describe it, it's like, sure. I mean, my directions are got to be clear. Yeah, of course I check if they're doing it. And then, of course, if someone's misbehaving, I try to stop them from misbehaving or use, you know, making a bad choice, but then
or
like
just slow following through. If I can make them quick follow through, then they won't misbehave in the first place again. Like I'm just prevention is so much better than cure.
Yeah. I recommend people actually check out all of your training because I get so many people saying I've never been to a good PD session. I've never, PD is awful. It's a big waste of my time. And I'm telling you, the Teach Like a Champion trainings I've been to make all of that noise go away. They are fantastic. And what I saw you do in there was you had teachers scripting out their directions.
Yeah.
And in doing the scripting, and in practicing with a partner, you get all these reactions to the process of realizing that this mundane thing is actually a lot harder sometimes than it looks. I mean, and this was with a pretty advanced group.
Yeah. It's so interesting because so many of the things that are difference makers in the classroom are pretty simple. I mean, not all of them, but like wait time is a great example of that. Like if I can cause myself to wait 3 or 4 seconds after I call on a student, before I take the first hand or before I call in the first student, like that is a game changer in terms of the number of students who feel like they can participate, in terms of the amount of cognition that students are doing. But even a very small, simple task like that in a complex environment like a classroom is hard to do, right? I find that even in workshops, like I struggle to demonstrate wait time myself when I'm talking about wait time to a group of, it's hard. And so even simple things require practice and reflection and rehearsal beforehand, right? I don't want to make mistakes or not sound like myself the first time I try it in front of kids. So I should get together with a group of colleagues who will be supportive and we'll have some fun doing it. And, but we'll get better so that when I walk out in the classroom, like, and I try it for the first time, I can do it with less load in my working memory. I'm more likely to be successful. I sound like me. I sound authentic. I feel authentic. So thank you for your kind words about our workshops. I really do believe that adults deserve to love professional development. It can be fun and rigorous at the same time. You know, one of the trickiest things for me about teaching always was that it felt so, you close your classroom door and you're the only adult in the room and no one ever sees you do it. And you know, all my life, I played team sports and they were profoundly important to me and my identity and who I was. And I think that teaching can be a team sport, especially if we make professional development sing for people where we get together and we practice with each other and we give each other feedback and we laugh a little bit, but we're pretty serious about the work. And so I do, and the other thing that I think is if you feel it as a learner, if you're in a great learning environment that where you're a little bit reluctant to cold call, but then you're in a room full of 80 people in a PD and you're cold called in a way that feels like caring and thoughtful and appreciative, and you find that actually you kind of like it and you feel successful, then you're much more willing to turn around and do it with your students. And so we always try to demonstrate in the workshop the things that we're talking about in the teaching so that people not just like understand it, but they feel it. And so I hope that came through. It's a real, like, it's really important to me that people love PD and that it served them and it makes them better.
One of the things I've been doing, I copied a lot of stuff. One of the things I've been doing is like the modeling vulnerability. Like you model what the what to do cycle would look like, or what the what a elements of it are, like the B scene looking. And it might be silly to, like, you have these kind of you've codified the B scene looking into like different moves, like the president and like the swivel and the invisible column. But you're like, all right, I'll do it, and then I'll do it with a partner. And oh, it was kind of funny. It was kind of silly, but let's try it together. All right, now you do it with a partner, but embedded in your instructions. You know, you do it in such a slick way. I'm almost jealous a little bit, because I'm trying to figure it out. You know, I guess over time you iterated and you figured out what works. You know.
And so if you're willing to point out your own mistakes, you both make it safe for other people to like make mistakes and get better during practice, but also you point out that that's actually a good thing. But I want to amplify the idea that like getting it wrong and then getting it right is what we do. You know, it's clear to us that that's what our students should be comfortable with, but it takes some time to be comfortable with it in an adult learning setting. And so she's really taught me to celebrate like the funny, awkward moments when you say something and it comes out a little bit wrong, or it just isn't like you shouldn't try and hide that. You should like laugh at it and point it out and then do it over better. And then other people feel comfortable doing the same thing.
There's a version of PD in which the presenter comes and they do their talk. And you know what? If you don't like it, you shouldn't have brought me in here. I'm not here to persuade you. And I'm not going to involve you, because if you're not invested mentally, it's not my responsibility, right? And I think you can kind of get along on the PD circuit kind of doing that. And it just feels insufficient to me. It feels wrong to be in that room doing that. And you take the exact opposite approach. And I wonder where that's, you know, it's tempting to not make adults want have to do stuff during the thing, you know?
And scary. Like, do I feel scared every time I walk into a room of a couple hundred people and I'm like, oof. And I know that I'm going to cold call, because if I don't cold call and we're going to be together, it's going to be like, either it's going to be like awkward and painful and I won't be able to engage you. I won't be able to use the alternating principle. I'll just talk at you and that will be boring for you and your attention will start to wander and it won't be as beneficial for you. Or if I allow, you know, volunteers only, it will be the same three or four people who are comfortable speaking in front of a room full of 150 or 200 people who aren't necessarily the people who should be, you know, no one wants to hear the same three people talking the whole time through. And they're not necessarily the people who should be talking. There's a lot of wisdom in the room. So I feel like I have an obligation to cold call in order to bring everyone's voice into the room. To cold call someone, I think when done well, says, your voice is important to your voice is important here. I'd love to hear from you. Teaching is the most important job in society. It's an immense responsibility and honor to be standing in front of that room, and I have to push myself to do the job as well as I can. And that means within the first 3 minutes of the workshop, I'm going to ask a provocative question. This is my recipe for starting a workshop. One, within the first 2 minutes, so there's a norm, so that like the longer you wait to start involving people, the stranger it gets. Within the first 2 minutes, ask a provocative question, which is a question that everyone can engage, but can't resolve. Let people prepare, let them turn and talk about it or write about it or both. So everyone's got an answer and everyone's thought it through. And then invite some people in the conversation. Zach, tell me what you and your partner talked about. Or Zach, I saw you writing on this. You looked really into it. Zach, I saw you gesturing at the graph on the screen. Like, tell us what you were talking about there. I even think like the language there, tell us about, get us started, like says you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to crack the case. Just as long as you share with us what's on your, I've caused you to think, share with us what you were thinking, then you are successful and we honor you. And so that's kind of always how I start. And then I want to just amplify the norm, the same one as I do with students, which is like when someone gives an answer, they're like, oh yeah, I see a lot of people nodding their heads. See a lot of people writing that down. That tells you that you are successful. It tells people in the room that when they show positive norms to other people notice it's a good thing to do. And it tells the person who spoke that they were successful. And I think that, you know, the research on cold call is really interesting, which is in classrooms, including with adults, when there's frequent cold calling, it's not just that people participate more because they were cold called. They participate more because they raise their hands more, because in many cases they participated in a setting where they weren't sure that they could, and they were successful, and they felt good about it. And now they're like, now I have something. Now I want to raise my hand. And I think that it's really important for people to feel that, even as a member of a group, to be a little bit, tiny bit anxious about like, am I really going to talk to a room full of 150 people? And by the end of the day, to be like, yeah, I did it. It was great. I'm fully capable of that. It was no problem at all. In fact, I kind of enjoyed it. We often, to go back to practice, the first time in PD set, when we say like, we're going to practice a lot today, like often, or the first time we practice in a workshop, there's always like five or six people are like, this is a great time to go to the bathroom. Like you can see the look of terror in people's eyes because maybe they haven't been in great practice before. But by the end of the workshop, the feedback that we always get is we should practice more. The practice was great. Like you should talk less. We should practice more.
I love it. Just kind of put a bow on this. So, backtracking, check out the what to do cycle parts of Teach Like a Champion 3.0. I have been emphasizing this with schools, because it's kind of like the almost like a with itness cycle. It's almost like a it's how to do that thing that you do over and over again, probably 18 times in the matter of an hour, but snappier, faster. Then you kind of add layers to it. You got to, add timings to it, add like silent solo in your notebook, certain memorizable phrases, and
That's right.
sort of create this arsenal in which it becomes a cycle of habit and you can concentrate on what the actually listening to the kids. I think it's,
I think that last point is like it's a habit for kids, it's a habit for you. And when you have a habit, it hacks working memory, it frees your working memory to allocate it to more important things. Like, what are the kids doing right now? What am I going to do next? To be more attentive to the one kid who looks like they need you to check in, or the one kid who really actually secretly wants you to call on them and they're looking at you and they're saying with their eyes, you call on me right now. And you're less likely to, one of the things we know about overloads on working memory is that they degrade perception. Right, you see less when your working memory is full, and so if you make these things habits for you, you will perceive more in your classroom.
I love it. There is another cluster that I think Teach Like a Champion is famous for, and that is active observation. And I just had Denarius Frazier on the podcast, and he was like, "I'm a proponent. I think it's the most important thing since sliced bread." And he gave his grand take on how his evolution in thinking about active observation. Maybe do for us the same you kind of did for the what to do cycle. Like, what is it, and what are its parts?
Sure. Thanks for asking. I will be a step down from Daenerys on this, but and in many cases, like the best video that we have of this in our workshops is of Daenerys. And so maybe I'll just kind of narrate a little bit of this, which is in this video that we have of him. He's got 30 10th graders in his classroom. He's teaching dividing polynomials, right? They're doing two problems with four steps each, and he's walking around the classroom trying to observe what is happening to learners. And so one of the things that I used to try to do this as a teacher all the time. And I would walk around the classroom and I would observe what was happening. And I'd walk by your desk, Zach, and I'd be like, ooh, that's great. Zach, I'm going to come to you. What an interesting thought you had here. Like I was an English teacher, so what an interesting thought. And I told myself I was taking mental notes. In a situation like this, there is no such thing as mental notes, right? There's too much information. Your working memory will be overloaded. You will forget it all. And I did this all the time. I forgot that I promised Zach that I was going to come to him for his brilliant idea. And then you're sitting there when I've forgotten to call on you. And you're like, well, did you think my idea was that brilliant or not? Or I would walk around the classroom and instead of observing that there are actually eight students who aren't eight, who don't understand how to write a topic sentence, I would react to the last student that I'd seen, which is, what they did with my working memory. And I would stop and I would talk to the whole class about what that one student had done instead of the thing that eight students had done. So I need to realize when that observing student work is incredibly important. I'm presented with a ton of data visually, and that if I think I can manage that data by holding it all in my working memory, I'm kidding myself. So the first thing that I need is a clipboard, and I need a place to write down observations about what I'm seeing. Zach, great answer. Remember to cold call. The other thing is that if I'm trying to think about and hold in my head what the right answer is, again, my working memory will be filled up just with that. I will observe less. I'll be able to remember less. So on that clipboard, for the two or three most important questions I'm going to ask, writing out an exemplar, here's what I hope students will say, is what strangely one of the most powerful things you can do. And so as I'm walking around observing things, I can glance at my clipboard, remind myself of what I wanted to look for, what I wanted to see, and give students very targeted feedback. Ooh, that's great. Love your topic sentence. See if you can add a transition there. And the interesting thing is that this allows me to build relationships with students because I'm able to give much more efficient, productive, targeted, personalized feedback. So I think a second thing that I need to do active observation, I need a place to write things down. I need a reminder for myself of what the ideal, what the goal is, what we're shooting for. And then the other thing that I know as I walk around is I'm gonna see mistakes, gonna see errors if I'm asking rigorous questions. And the problem is that's data that I have to track. What is the error? What's the common? First of all, if I think about errors in advance, I'm more likely to notice them. And so I think the smartest thing you can do is on this active observation sheet, write down the two or three errors that you think students will make. And now I can just tick off and like almost make a histogram of like, am I seeing these errors? Which errors are most common? And then I know what to stop and talk about with students. And so having these three pieces, which is place to write down, place to process the data, description of the right answer, description of potential wrong answers, allows me to understand and process all the things that are happening in my class in real time while they're doing work, while they're doing written work. And I just think that, and strangely, I think that this allows me to be more relationship oriented, to have little moments with students where look at a student's work, I notice their mistake quickly, I may give them a short piece of useful feedback, I pat them on the shoulder, then I glance down at my exemplar to remind myself of what I'm looking for the next student. And off I go, and I'm able to give every student a piece of like really nice, thoughtful feedback that says they matter and I care about them in 5 seconds per student. So that's the idea behind active observation. I think there are a lot of different ways that you can adapt it. You know, you could give feedback to every student, or you could decide not to give feedback to every student and just kind of hold back some of your thoughts and just tabulate the data. You could go by every student. You could just pick a couple students that you think are really important to check in with, right? I think there are a lot of ways to adapt this, but the fundamental model of like, you must have a place to write things down to if you expect to observe, otherwise you will be overwhelmed. Your working memory will be overwhelmed and you will forget. And you should remind yourself what you're looking for and what the likely mistakes are.
Excellent. And you know, I think with active observation, like it, for me, it's different and it's innovative compared to kind of the default version of this. I think everybody would say like, sure, like if I can get around, I can get around. And I try to listen in, I try to lean in, mainly perhaps so everybody knows that I'm watching, you know, there's layers to how you launch it. There's layers to like what you do to set it up for yourself, so you don't have like that situation where every single kid has an error. You basically are you know, like, can you maybe break down some of the nuances behind behind this technique?
Yeah, it's great. I think one of the most useful things I can do is just be thinking. I think all learning starts with attention. What are we paying attention to? And so if I think back to this Denarius video, the very first thing he says is, I'm coming around to check your remainder. That's a really interesting statement, which is he says that because he's thought in advance, what should they be thinking about while they're working? What should be in their working memory while they're solving this problem? The thing that's most likely to trip them up, the thing that's most challenging, that requires the most desirable difficulty, is the remainder. And so because attention is invisible, I think we often overlook how central it is to learning. And that one of the most important things that a teacher does is shape attention, right? Just direct attention. So if I say, I'm coming around to check your remainder, yes, it's a statement of accountability, which is like, I will be walking around to watch your work. But if I say, I'm coming around to check your remainder, I'm orienting you to focus on that before I've given you any feedback. And I just think like those moments where we're attentive to student attention are so important because, you know, they keep mistakes from happening. And so I think that's one just like really powerful piece that you can add to your active observation game. I know that there are a couple schools that, you know, like they bought, there's a school I know in England that they came to a workshop. We talked about active observation. They bought everyone a clipboard. I don't know, like people were like mocking them for like, oh, a clipboard, like that's a big deal. Like it kind of is a big deal, right? To have a system to gather data. We should just recognize that that looking, observing is it's a relatively passive activity. We don't feel like we're teaching when we're looking, but it's the first step to almost everything that we do, like to informing our decisions in the classroom. That like being able to look efficiently and effectively is incredibly important. And having a tool to cause myself to be better at remembering what I've seen and disciplining myself to observe, like that's a really, really powerful thing. A clipboard costs $3 and it's like the most important thing you can buy for all of your teachers. And in some ways, because it builds the system, which is like, it is a reminder for your own attention. When I give independent seat work, I'm going to walk around with my clipboard and I'm going to remind myself to observe what students are doing and take notes on it. And if I can do that, I'm so much farther ahead.
Well, I just back relating it back to PD again. This happens to me every time is I stand there and I sort of stand in place because I know that's important to like not beeline it to the first students, kind of do a B scene looking and make sure everyone's doing the thing. And then I start walking around, and immediately after I collect two responses in my working memory without a clipboard, I go, okay, so I either want to stop this now so I don't forget about it, or when I get up in front of everyone, I'm kind of scared to go down that rabbit hole because I have to rearticulate something that I haven't fully processed, so I might just skip it, and
Can I say
there's,
two things about that? Yeah, it's just like one is like what you're describing is working memory overloads. We're talking here about working the frequency of working memory overloads for teachers. Working memory overloads are stressful. They induce anxiety. So this feeling like I'm going to forget this, I'm anxious about it, like keeps you from being from connecting with your students, from gathering further data. And so it's I think it's really important to be that you describe that, to be in touch with that, with that feeling of the anxiety of the working memory overload. I think the other thing about anticipating errors, the next step after I've anticipated errors, I can think in advance about what I might do about it. And one of the reasons why teachers bury, I would say, bury the data all the time, which is they walk around the classroom and they pretty much they're like aware that like kids are really struggling with remainders. It is a really scary thing in the middle of a, halfway through a lesson that you've planned in front of 30, eighth graders or 10th graders or fourth graders to be like, okay, I'm going to rip up my lesson plan right now. And I'm going to freelance and I'm going to try and off the top of my head, explain to students what they don't understand about remainders. But if I've anticipated errors and I've thought in advance about like the, I've thought about, well, what will I do about it if I see this mistake? What's like, what is, and so I don't have to decide on the spur of the moment. I can kind of have hatched a plan in the back of my head already. And then I'm like, I am much more likely to step in if I feel confident about my ability to remediate the issue as opposed to if I leave it to myself to think of it on the spur of the moment when I'm doing a bunch of other things. So the kind of related step between anticipating errors, what are the errors? Like, write them down and then just think a little bit like, okay, if I see this, what am I going to do about it? Like that. Not only makes the fix better, it makes you much more likely to stop, to pause and say, pause, guys, eyes up here. Let me explain something to you. I'm going to teach you again how to factor. Like, let's go through this one more time. And if I thought about how I'm going to do that, I'm much more likely to be able, I'm much more likely to actually do it. And all the time, teachers will be like, they'll teach something, kids will do poorly on a quiz, and they'll be like, I knew it. I kind of knew in my mind that they didn't understand, right? That is an example of you burying the data, which is you knew it, but you didn't quite have the guts to step up and do something about it, and a little bit of preparation goes a long, long way in getting over that hurdle.
I love it. So again, check out the active observation pages. I've got these sticky notes on these too. It's just like one of those books I've turned over and over. I think Adam Boxer told me about, he related it to religious text and how, sometimes it's not about getting another book. It's just about turning the same book over and over again. I thought that was a really smart thing. So check that out. We're coming to the end, but I feel like the inevitable endpoint or logical next step for Teach Like a Champion. You talk about kids aren't paying attention, books are not being taught, and rigor is slipping out. Instruction is so important, and then the science of reading has just become such a movement. The logical next step is curriculum, and so you sort of. I don't know if how many people know about Reading Reconsidered as a curriculum. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, I'd love to. So Reading Reconsidered, right now it's grades 5 to 8. We're expanding to 9 to 12 in the coming year or two. It is it's a curriculum. So as a teacher, if you have it, you get daily lesson plans that you can, they're scripted for you, but they're designed to be adapted. And of course, you can change them if you want to. But a teacher shouldn't have to invent a lesson plan because a good lesson plan takes a lot of work. And so I would describe it as it's book-based. So it's you teach 5 or 6 novels a year, and it's knowledge rich. So in a unit on a given book, we would like each day we would embed little nonfiction passages to illuminate. So if you're reading Number of the Stars, for example, which is set in Denmark during the resistance, so the Nazis during World War II, there might be a passage on rationing, like what was rationing and why, why did people do it, or resistance movements, or like they celebrate Rosh Hashanah, like there's a little passage on Rosh Hashanah, so you understand more about the novel, right? You have background knowledge on it. And also you understand, you pick up more of the nonfiction because you have this character who's going through it and you understand. So you read it in a way that is or engage. This is a lot of work to prep this level of curriculum. So every day in the lesson plan, there are like little nonfiction passages to illuminate the novel reading. So it's novel based, it's knowledge rich, it's writing intensive, which is so important. You know, the ability to sustain focus in reading is important, and so is the ability to sustain focus in writing. So there's lots and lots of writing every day. There's a lot of what I would call formative writing, which I think is really important. Formative writing is, we define as writing that you do before you know, before you're sure of the answer. So a lot of the writing that students do in classrooms are summative writing, which is like explain your opinion and justify it with evidence. And that is important. It's one of the things we do in school. But another kind of writing is we're reading a chapter from The Giver, pause. Jonas's feelings are changing about the role that he's been given to do. Take 30 seconds, jot down your first thoughts. Why might he be changing? How is his opinion changing? Go, right? And when I ask students to do that, I'm asking them to use writing as a tool to discover what they think, as opposed to explain what they think. They think hard, they think slowly, they think carefully, and everybody in the room is answering the question. And then I go to discussion. Great, tell me what you wrote about. Zach, get us started. What were some of your first thoughts here? And I just think that using writing, letting students use writing as a tool to discover what they think, to deepen their own thinking, to prepare for discussion is so profoundly important. So some of the things that I think you would find in the it's book based, it's knowledge rich, it's writing intensive. The other thing about it is you get to choose the books, so it's modular. So we have at each grade level there are sort of 10 books you can choose from. You choose the 5 or 6 that most speak to you and your kids, and hopefully, you know, there's a combination of sort of classics and some new, you know, some new hits and things like that that let you choose the right portfolio of books for your students. So that's Reading Reconsidered. Again, it's 5 to 8 right now. We're expanding into high school, which I think is like there's so little quality curriculum in high school, and high school teachers are just, you know, forced to go out and either lesson plan rigorously for hours a night, or to, you know, frankly, you just have to cut corners on what you can do because it's really hard to prepare a great curriculum around a really important novel. And so I think if like, if you have lesson preparation done for you, even if you want to change some things about it, you can, or if you have lesson planning done for you, you can focus on lesson preparation, which is like, what is the exemplar I want for this answer? What are the mistakes they're likely to make? You know, you can focus on all the active observation stuff that we've been, you can focus on preparation, the planning is done for you.
I you know, a lot of people come to me asking about the secondary options, and you know, I can give them a list of K-2 reading programs.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It is, I think it's time for folks who are in that space to not just try to solve the upstream problem, but also to address what's happening downstream. So I really do recommend people check it out. I'll provide some links in the show notes. Doug, we could talk for hours. Our time has come to an end. I really appreciate having you on the podcast, and I think that the listeners are going to get a kick out of this one. Let's keep this going with more great, you know, great collaborations in the future. I really appreciate coming on.
Oh, thanks, Zach. I really enjoyed it. It was great to see you, and you're happy to come back anytime.
All right, we'll talk soon. Take care.
Cheers.